Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy, now it's like really the off-season week.
Yep, and you guys asked for it, so now you're going to get real off-season content here.
So off-season that I don't know that either of us really even know what that's going to be until we start up.
Yeah, well, we do have some things. I mean, they're like tangentially related to Syracuse. Talk about the NFL draft that Syracuse probably won't be much involved in. There's also some new NCAA rules, which are nice and actually have positive effects, I think, for Syracuse.
I saw those came out like right as I was leaving work, and I didn't get to read the full thing. Is it just the transfer thing and there was one other part?
Oh, there's so much more.
Oh, well, please fill me in and let's discuss.
We'll go part by part here. I'm also going to write an article about this for Thursday morning. So, there will be a new recruiting model that resembles the schedule other students follow while choosing where to go to college, which the language there is just amazing to me because it basically admits outright that the way that they go to college is not the same in any way, shape, or form.
Speak for yourself. Nancy Cantor gave a very nice presentation in my living room.
Greg Robinson actually showed up in my living room, and
he just was checking to see if you had any jobs because he knew, like, you know, he knew what was coming.
He figured, you know what, like, I'm going to get this guy mad enough that it's going to affect the next four head coaches Syracuse has. Let's just pre-aggravate him.
It'd be funnier if it wasn't true.
But yeah, so for things for the recruiting experience, student athletes in sports other than football and basketball, they can now take official visits starting September 1st of their junior year. Instead of the first day of classes for senior year, that makes it a little bit easier. Football changes recruiting model last year. Men's basketball is the same. And women's basketball will now be following the same, well, where you'll be able to start junior year.
I like that. I think that it just, like, there's been this whole thing about how, like, recruitment doesn't really, and by thing I mean, like, in terms of NCAA parlance, where, like, recruits can't receive official offers until they're juniors and all this other nonsense. Like, recruiting starts when they're, like, freshmen at this point for a lot of kids, so let's at least, like, extend out the timeline in which they can do, like, official visits and stuff like that and give them the most opportunity to learn what they can about the schools that they're looking at.
They decided no on a bunch of good football things. They tabled the proposal to allow student-athletes to participate in up to 4 football games per year without losing a season of eligibility. They'll be providing feedback and reviewing that for maybe another time. FCS removed restrictions on employing individuals associated with prospective student-athletes at a school's camp or clinic. That doesn't really matter for us. And both subdivisions adopted proposals preventing former student-athletes participating in practice at their former schools. Huh.
I saw that one. That's like the Alabama rule, essentially, yeah. Where, like, Blake Sims would come in and scout team quarterback.
Right.
Which, like, I don't know. I don't have any really strong feelings about that either way.
See, it was sponsored by the ACC, which... All right. I can see where we're going with this.
I assume Clemson just complained when Alabama did it like 2 years in a row before Deshaun Watson.
But the thing is, like, Clemson in 5 years can probably bring back an entire, you know, fleet of All-Americans to do this if they wanted to. But I think the idea here is that by allowing former, like, star players to practice with the team, it becomes a recruiting advantage that not everybody has access to.
That's fair, and that's, like, a legit thing. Like, you could say, like, oh, you can come to Alabama and practice against, you know, Trent Richardson.
Right.
If that's a thing people want. So I'm not too worked up about that. I don't think that, like, really disadvantages student-athletes at all.
Yeah. We also have that transfer rule did go through, which will allow players to kind of just tell their schools, hey, I'm transferring, and then they enter a new transfer pool, and that'll allow them to enter that national database, be re-recruited. They'll still be subject to conference rules, however, so chances are you still aren't really going to be able to move much in conference, which Sure, that's fine.
Yeah, like, I get, like, ideal world in terms of, like, what the players should be able to do. Like, you probably would hope that they'd be able to just kind of do whatever, but I get, like, as a compromise, keeping it from, like, a vindictive quarterback, you know, transferring to, like, straight-up division rival, just, like, I understand why that's a restriction that they're holding on to, and I think there are far worse things than, like, limiting, you know, cutting out, like, 10 schools out of 130 that a football player that can transfer to. So, yeah, like, another one that, like, it's definitely a major improvement. I think they got, like, most of the way there.
Yeah, and to be honest, the one thing that I would have maybe added, I mean, ideally, I'd love the, like, you know, one free transfer rule that a lot of people have floated out there. Another just idea here would be, and it's something we discussed when Gus Edwards wasn't allowed to come to Syracuse or Pitt last year, was if you're a grad transfer, you go wherever the hell you want. You're done. You're done. Right. You're done with what you had to do to play.
Yeah, and in most cases, I think that's what goes on.
Except in the case of Gus Edwards.
For some reason.
We could have really used him, actually, since he ended up running for, like, over 700 yards for Rutgers.
Yep.
The other thing that we will definitely care about on this show, there are no more restrictions around the sale of alcohol at Division I championships.
That was just, like, such a no-brainer, and we've seen this, like, whole... Like, when I started at Syracuse, I think we were, like, maybe... we might have been the only FBS football school that allowed sales of alcohol on campus, and at least in an on-campus football stadium. And that's, like, totally, like, cascading down now. We're if, probably not the majority yet, because I know the SEC doesn't allow it, but, like, so many of the arenas have added it every year. It's just a no-brainer. Like, people are... Like, studies show that people are going to be more drunk if you don't allow it because they're going to tailgate like crazy.
Yeah.
It's free money. It's just
the NCAA,
like,
loves free things.
Yes, it takes them a little while to realize what becomes free money for them. But once you explain it, they're all in, because the NCAA, this may shock you, is a capitalist enterprise and not
a
this,
capitalist,
like,
nonprofit. However,
yes, it is not this, like, Puritan. I mean, I guess it is technically a nonprofit, but they do like to make money. It's weird.
I mean, I've walked past their expansive Indianapolis headquarters, and yeah, that's that. Of course, it looks like every other nonprofit I've ever been near, with you know, something that takes up a large plot of land in downtown Indianapolis.
Yes, and a major American city. Just they're all just punching their cards, doing the right thing for you know. The disenfranchised youth, they're always looking out for them.
Of course. So yeah, I think the alcohol thing is pretty good. Welcome to making money to everyone else. Once I saw that Wake Forest was willing to sell beer, I knew it was only a matter of time before the rest of the college community jumped in. So,
and Wake was, like, relatively early on it too.
They were an early adopter for once.
Yeah. With their fancy beer tent.
Yeah, I if I recall, you and I were discussing it the last time we were there, and
Time I was there was a monsoon.
Oh God, yeah, that's true. So you needed a beer.
I didn't even get one. I don't think I would have been able to carry it back.
This is true.
I was trying to stay, like, relatively unmiserable, which I failed at.
For so many reasons, most of which because you were at a Syracuse Wake Forest football game.
Yes. Which were actually fun for a long time, and then the last 2 years, not so much.
Yeah. But on to happier things in Syracuse football. I made an attempt to rank the 10 best NFL draft picks in Orange history today, and people got annoyed because I didn't put Jim Brown first. And Dan, what's your opinion on that? Do you think Jim Brown should just automatically be first, and that Marvin Harrison can just sit second and just get over it?
I'm looking at it now. I mean, it's hard. It's very hard not to put Jim Brown first.
I know.
I know why you did it, because I've also written things for the internet. I like that you updated it. I just saw that, because I looked at it earlier.
Yeah, because I was just sick of fucking hearing about it.
Yeah. It's hard to really take any exception to this. Were you trying to do, like, a value thing? Like a
Less value, more just, like, who are the 10 best players drafted?
Yeah, so then... You know, Harrison's a no-brainer. Dwight Freeney, I think we all think should be a Hall of Famer. At least from this side of the Syracuse aisle, I assume we all think that. He's also, like, a pretty, like, impactful defensive end for a long time for a Super Bowl winning team. I think it's hard to really argue. Art Monk, Donovan is close. I mean, we've had a lot of really good NFL players, is what this reminds me. I mean, when number 10 is Chandler Jones, who, is on his way to, like, a multiple Pro Bowl, like, one of the better defensive ends in the NFL for a long stretch, like, career, and he's probably the only one that falls short of, like, if not legend, then, like, borderline Hall of Famer. That's pretty good.
Well, the arguments, I know there were a couple people that said Jones didn't belong there. Some of the people that commenters brought up were better than others. Some of the folks people mentioned, Riley Dixon was mentioned as a joke, not in seriousness. Keith Bullock and Donovan Darius, both of whom were good players, but I do feel like people are overhyping what was maybe one or two really good years for each of those guys, and extending it out. I mean, their numbers just don't really stack up.
Yeah, like, Keith Bullock and Donovan Darius were, like, their best years were, like,
not
what Chandler Jones has done a bunch already.
Exactly. And,
I mean, I think if Chandler Jones was, like, if his career just, like, falls off a cliff in, like, a year or two, maybe you could argue those two guys get in over, on longevity. But I think Jones' top-end years. I mean, what did he just have, like, 16 sacks?
He had 17 sacks. He led the league. He was the first team, and he was first team All-Pro.
Yeah, and that wasn't his first good year either. Like, he had like two or three really, really great years with the Patriots. So it's hard to argue that. I think it's also hard because, like, his career is far from over, hopefully, and those two are done now. And they had the thing they had was, like, a lot of longevity. I think they both played like a decade in the league, right? And were pretty reliable starters for a long time.
Yeah, they were.
So yeah, I think you can make an argument there, but overall, it seems like Chandler's career is probably projecting higher.
Yeah. The other guys I would maybe end, like, it was interesting, too, because, like, I knew about Jim Ringo and I knew his history, but actually, like, reading through and seeing, like, just how much, like, he was somebody who, like, I could have even been convinced to put higher than I did. The only guy I might put ahead, I thought Joe Morris for a few, but Joe Morris's numbers really are based on 85 and 86 seasons in which he ran for over half of his, like, career yardage in just 2 years. Gary Anderson, I would entertain taking Chandler's spot, if only because of just how prolific he was, how he is one of the, you know, one to three probably best kickers in league history. He's one of the top scorers in league history. I could definitely entertain him.
Yeah, it's tough with kickers because it's such a specialized thing, and I'm a proponent of, like, putting kickers and punters into the Hall of Fame because it's a part of the game. Like, if you want to, if it becomes no longer part of a game, then, you know, you can argue it. But right now, it's like a pretty big part of football. So I think they should get, like, you know, they should get the accolades that everyone else gets within their own, like, realm. So, but overall, it's hard to argue even. You could maybe argue Anderson for 10 just because he was, like, one of the best at his position, but there's always going to be that bias against the specialists like that, and I get it.
Yeah. So you want to put him 10th instead, go for it. I'm not going to stop anybody.
And you can say a similar thing about Tabucky Jones, who was one of the best, like, special teams, like, non-kick returner, non-kicker punter, like, players that we in the NFL for a long time.
Yeah, I buy that. Let me do a little... we can talk a little bit about Western Michigan while we're here, because... I started my way too early opponent previews this week. We are starting against Western Michigan this year, over in Kalamazoo. This should be fun. Most notably, we're seeing Tim Lester again. Now, Dan, what do you recall about the Method Cat offense and all things Method Cat?
I remember buying an XFL trading card when he was named offensive coordinator. And that's about like the extent of. I actually found that the other day. It's in my apartment up here in
the submarine.
Ah, good lord. I assume his offense at Western Michigan's. I watched like parts of some of their games last year. I think they gave USC a run, right?
USC and Michigan State. Like, I was kind of wondering, like, where the hell was, like, what the hell went on when the people running this offense were. Like, two of the guys were instrumental in the Lester offense at Syracuse, and the results could not have looked any more different.
And obviously, he adopted, like, kind of a tough situation because P.J. Fleck, like, bounced after his, like, best possible year.
Yeah.
So he didn't inherit, like, a full stacked roster. Most of the offense was gone.
Yeah, most of the offense was gone. He had most of his defense, however. But the offense looked not have. I mean, the run game was good for the most part, and it had injuries,
which was not the case at Syracuse, if you remember.
It was. Well, I remember. I watched every game twice, Dan.
good Lord. Yeah, I mean, I think it's so weird because I think he was also put in a weird spot that first year because he took over at midseason and he tried to shoehorn in and work with this system based on the bones of what McDonald had been doing. And then the second year, we just went all in on this weird option type attack, even though that probably wasn't the best possible thing we could be doing. So without having seen a ton of Western Michigan, it doesn't totally surprise me that he's doing a better job offensively based on being able to go in and having a full offseason to implement what he wants as a head coach. But at the same time, it doesn't leave him with a lot of room for excusing what happened his final year where he had a full year as offensive coordinator at Syracuse.
Yeah, and I mean, it is just I understand some of the problems here, but at the same time, it's Lester and Jake Moreland, two guys who were involved for Syracuse. And again, this offense could not look any. It's not like it's great, but at the same time, with three Syracuse staffers, I feel like they've already gotten more out of this Western Michigan team. Even last year when they went 6-6 and they missed the postseason because they ran out of both slots for the MAC. The results here were still pretty damn good. I mean, they scored 71 points in the game. That was entertaining-ish.
Oh, I remember that game. That was nuts.
That was when Tim Lester and I lost my mind, wrote an article about it. That Tim Lester was part of the highest scoring game in college football history now. After a record in which Syracuse was a part of.
Good Lord.
Just why. But yeah, last year they had a really good running game, actually. They had an okay offense. They were middle tier, maybe a little bit lower. They tested USC. They tested Michigan State. They went 4-4 in conference, which not bad, especially in a really tough kind of. I'd put the MAC West up there among the hardest divisions in G5. The only one that might be tougher is probably the American Athletic Conference West.
Yeah, there are a lot of just really competent programs in the MAC West, and obviously the talent level is going to have a ceiling, but they seem to hire coaches well. Obviously it's churned out so many, especially Big Ten coaches in the last couple of years. So yeah, 6-6 your first year when you're replacing basically the whole of a really prolific offense and finding some kind of identity. I'd say it was a fairly successful year. Especially cause we could have talked ourselves into Lester, totally falling off a cliff. Now, that being said, now, as he starts to have to replace, more defensive guys, from that really good 2016 team, then there are still some question marks, as you always get when you move away from the last coach's players with a new coaching hire.
What we are seeing with him, though, is that he's actually recruiting pretty well. And again, where the hell was this at Syracuse? This past class had 19 three-star guys. So that's not going to floor us at Syracuse, but that's pretty damn good for a MAC school.
It's not what Fleck was doing, where Fleck was recruiting a bottom level P5, to be honest, when he was there. But it's still quite good for what any other MAC coach would be doing. Yeah. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's not like Fleck left his staff behind.
No,
I think he hired most everyone.
He wrote over most everyone. They ranked 75th in the 24/7 composite this year. That was second in the MAC. I think Toledo was first, which makes sense just because they've been able to keep a pretty consistent vibe going there.
They also, I looked into this at some point writing an article a couple months ago. Toledo hasn't made a bad coaching hire in a long, long time.
No.
decades.
Yeah, Toledo, I wrote about them.
I'll find it, because it was a note in a much different article I wrote. But it was I just dove into it because it was so surprising to me. And I knew Saban was there for a hot second, and it just blew my mind how long it had been since a truly bad hire by them.
Yeah, I wrote. Yeah, I thought you wrote about that. I know I wrote about that last year when I wrote about just MAC coaching hires. Yeah, Jason Candle's been there for the last 2 years and a bowl game. Matt Campbell was there before. Tim Beckman wasn't a bad
coach for them. Tom Amsthis was a pretty good coach. Gary Pinkel was a pretty good coach. Saban was there for one season.
I found it. The last, which you were about to get to, because you were going down the list. Yeah. The last Toledo coach who was left the program under 500 was Chuck Stobart, who was there from 77 to 81.
And even that, he was... That- Even he ended his time with a 9-3 record, California Bowl win.
Yeah, for whatever reason, and the MAC, like, it seems like the MAC, like, kind of shifts between what teams are good, like, aside from, like, Eastern Michigan for a long time being horrible. Like, the MAC is pretty up and down. Like, you've done these runs based on who hires a good coach, and it's really remarkable that Toledo has just kind of bucked the trend of, like, having up and down periods, like, almost every other school in that conference does. It's basically Toledo and Eastern Michigan are the only relatively consistent ones, and on either end of the spectrum, and everyone else is just like swings rapid, like violently either way.
Yeah, I know Bill Connolly got into that actually in his like intro for the WMU preview this year, where he said like outside of like, you know, the recent-ish run for Northern Illinois, like, and even them, like, they've kind of, you know, taken a little bit of a downward turn. Like, the MAC is a lot of wild swings just because there's so much coaching turnover. Like, it is, you know, a cradle of coaches type situation. And the Big Ten looks there a lot. The ACC has been mining there quite a bit. The American Athletic Conference potentially, like, could even look there depending on which school and how much they can pay. Like, it's always been a very interesting conference in that regard, but it's become an even more interesting conference. So, yeah, Toledo is definitely kind of the school I think WMU is trying to emulate. And honestly, like, if Lester works out for them, he could really work out, because it's not that he wouldn't ever want to go anywhere else, but I don't necessarily know if his level of success is going to be such a system and personality based thing like it was with Fleck or other MAC coaches who've left, that you can say like, okay, he's definitely going to get hired somewhere. I think part of the draw to play for him is the fact that he's an alum.
He also, as we know very well, was not some, like, super hot coordinator when he got hired there. So it kind of takes away, like, you know, if he had led Syracuse to, like, some crazy offense and then got that job, you would be – you almost expect a little bit more that he might leave at some point versus, like, the fact is that, like, Syracuse was pretty bad on offense while he was here.
Mm-hmm. And then so Lester got to the line.
Yes, he definitely cut the line because he's an alum. And I think that I don't know for sure. Just speculating, it could make some other teams more hesitant to try to like bump him up the line.
Right. Yeah. Like Western Michigan would have to get back to the Fleck heights under him for him to make another move in the next probably 3 to 4 seasons.
Right.
Which, I mean, you know what? Like I don't wish anything bad on any of the former SU coaches. I think Schaefer can go shove his cigar somewhere. But besides that, I hope all of them find success. You know, Lester was always a good guy. SU media really liked him. It's not that he inherited a bad situation. I felt like he didn't necessarily do the greatest job with the situation he inherited. But alas, he's gone now. He can't hurt us anymore. At least once we get past this WMU series, which I think is just this one game, if memory serves. Actually, no, I don't think it is. Memory is serving by me pulling it up on here. Nope, we got Western Michigan next year. We're hosting them on September 21st. So it is a two-gamer now that I jogged my memory there.
Yeah, we don't get one for zeros. We're not actually, no one really gets those anymore. Yeah, but
we got a Middle Tennessee last year.
Oh, you're right. They had a weird situation, though, didn't they?
I think they had a weird situation. We obviously had a weird situation. I'm pretty sure we shelled out like over $1 million for that one.
I think it was actually a little less, but it was maybe it was over $1 million. It was a lot. It was somewhere in like the $850,000 to like maybe over $1 million range. Either way, like that, we generally don't get one-offs. Most schools at this point don't. Like if you're an SEC school, you can get one, but like rarely. A Syracuse type school really struggles to.
Yeah, like even I think I saw Arkansas has gone on the road somewhere that I was surprised by.
You're right. Where did they go recently?
Oh, they're going to Colorado State.
They're going to, a couple people are going to Colorado State. Arkansas went to did they go to Toledo or did they go to Tulsa recently?
They did go to Toledo recently.
Okay.
And I think they lost that game.
Knowing recent Arkansas, early in the year, probably.
Yeah. Speaking of losing games like that, I gave us a 60% chance to win this game. Bill and S&P Plus gives us a 52% chance to win this game.
Yeah, I just saw that. It's, I don't know. It's hard to, I have trouble really projecting forward what they're going to be. Western Michigan and also, like,
Syracuse.
I don't know. I feel much better than 52%.
I do, and I think a lot of it, and this isn't, like, the fault of Bill or S&P Plus. It's just, like, because Dungy hasn't seen a full season, because we've had so many injuries, because we're losing a decent amount of returning production, and because recruiting hasn't really been, like, lights out, all of those things are hurting us here. And Western Michigan does get assisted by the fact that, like, S&P does include recent results, and one of their recent results is an undefeated regular season.
Yep. Also, it was Toledo. It was 2015 Arkansas lost to Toledo 16-12, which is a bizarre football score.
I watched half of that game, at least, and I don't know why.
I imagine I watched at least part of it. It was my birthday. It was novelty. My 25th birthday.
Figured everything's going well today, so why don't I knock it down a notch just so I don't have weighty expectations going forward?
I mean, it was week 2 of the college football season. That's always, like, a big step down, so there's a good chance that I was watching at least, like, a chunk of that. Especially because, like, watching SEC teams lose to Drupal 5s is hilarious.
Oh, sign me up every time. I remember, what was it, like, 2 years ago when Auburn was about to lose to Jacksonville State? And they didn't, but I was psyched. I think most of college football Twitter was pretty psyched, and then, you know, it didn't happen.
That was great, and Florida losing to Georgia Southern before Georgia Southern was at FBS was just, like, chef kiss emoji. Like, it's so good. I was in Syracuse for that. I was staying with a friend who was an RA on campus after we graduated, and at I assume I was up for a football, I forget which. Just great. Watching it was just like one of those wonderful moments, and we all knew Florida was trash, but, like, that was so much. And obviously Georgia Southern was really good, but still.
All right, why don't we do a little halftime here, and then we can pivot to some other, maybe more Syracuse-related topics.
Cool, I'm pulling up Untappd because it... Oh, you know what? Like, literally the only craft beer I had this week, I stopped at Dinosaur for lunch one day and got an Ape Anger. And that was really it. I didn't, like, drink much last weekend.
All right.
So, I'm punting.
Fair enough. All right, for me... Hung out with some friends down in South Redondo. Went to one of the better beer bars around here, Naja's Place. Had from Green Cheek, which is down in the Orange County area. Had a new neon sign, pale ale. Really good. Really a lot of flavor, especially for a pale ale. Tasted much far beyond the 5.5% it was. Had a Vic Secret Eyes from McKellar. It was a New England IPA. Also went to one of my other favorite spots, Select Beer Store. Had a Barrel Roll Number 4 Hammerhead from Hangar 24. Had a Crooked Stave Hops Avant. Was a Brett IPA from them. Had a bottle of Divine Reserve Number 15. It was a Russian Imperial Stout from St. Arnold down in Texas. Had a Primer Weizenbach from Live Oak, also from Texas. And then a Lambic from Brewery's Tyrell label, their Train to Beer Cell. Really, really good beer. Actually got even better as you went. Always a big fan of Lambics, so yeah, that was my week of beer drinking. And
Lambics, I feel like I always really enjoy, and I just don't, like, I don't drink them. It feels like it's one of those things where, like, you feel weird ordering it on, like, a normal night, even though they're, like, delicious, and I probably should drink them more because I always enjoy them.
I mean, there's also, like, I mean, you can probably get access to the Genuine Article Belgian ones a little bit more easily than we can out here. But there are plenty of American breweries doing, like, really approaching Belgian lambics well and finding ways to, you know, both be a similar, you know, product to the original Belgian style and also, like, trying some new things with it. I know, like, Beechwood Blendery is really trying some new and different things with lambics and adding fruit and stuff like that. And it's I have no problem trying them out because, again, I'm a sucker for that style.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I had a really good one, but I might now make a point of it now that it's come up here. I might have to, like, next time I see one on the menu, I'm just going to go for it.
Or find a Belgian beer bar. I'm sure there's...
Oh, there are definitely Belgian beer bars, yeah. I mean, I know of a couple, so.
Fair enough. Okay. I guess one thing that we could definitely talk about here, Jim won't be on with us, but Syracuse lacrosse. Dan, I know that you don't have time to watch as many Syracuse lacrosse games as you'd like, just like I don't either, but Syracuse did go undefeated in the ACC again, and that could be a harbinger of some good things to come, but it wasn't last year.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously think you'll take it rather than not. I got to see the last quarter of that UNC game, which was a very Syracuse lacrosse event where it was highly thrilling and it looked like we were definitely going to lose, and then we pulled it out somehow with a weird, like, crazy three-goal from behind comeback in the last, like, couple minutes. So it's always so funny how lacrosse just, like, so often Syracuse just seems to do exactly the amount of goals it needs in the exact amount of time and then win in overtime. And it doesn't really seem to matter if there's, like, 2 minutes left or 7 minutes left.
It seems just like they're flirting with disaster, though.
Yes, all the time. And it's highly frustrating, but also incredibly thrilling.
Yeah, the fact that all of our big wins are in conference, and we've played so... I think, like, in past years, if we lost big games out of conference, they weren't by a mile, and you felt like, okay, like, if some things had bounced a different way. Like, but what we're seeing with this Syracuse team is just everything is so night and day. I mean, they got blown up by Cornell. They got blown up in one of the worst losses we've ever seen by Albany. Those are not wins that are necessarily usually indicative of a team that's going to win the ACC in lacrosse. And I don't know if I think it might be a little bit of a down year, to be honest, for the conference. But like you see that Notre Dame's taken some losses, Duke's taken some losses. Obviously, we have not the strongest year for the ACC. Obviously, those wins against those programs still matter. And if we manage to win the ACC tournament, that'll bolster our chances even more. But this does feel weird and very different from what we're used to in terms of, you know, Syracuse taking on those non-conference L's.
Yeah, like, this doesn't... It's probably a lot because of those Albany and Cornell games, which were just such, like, blowout losses, and the fact that those weren't in the ACC almost makes it seem like the ACC might have been down, and that might be the case. But overall, it doesn't feel like a great Syracuse team. It's a pretty young team. I know the attack's been, like, a work in progress all year. The defense, I think, has been relatively good without, like, watching it as closely as, like, you know, I just don't get all the teams down here, but I've watched as much as I can, and so, yeah, it doesn't have the feel of, like, a team that I think should be challenging for a national title, but they're definitely really gritty. They pulled out, like, a couple of games this year that they probably had no business winning, including this UNC one, and it's really, like, I'm not planning on counting out Syracuse lacrosse in any big game, so... I'm definitely of, like, a couple different minds. I don't think if they lose, you know, before the Final Four in the NCAA tournament, I'll be, like, terribly upset, though, because I do feel like this is, like, a little bit more of a, not quite a rebuild year, but it's definitely more of, like, a revamped team that should be really good in years to come. But overall, I think you have to be happy with how the regular season played out overall, even aside from the undefeated ACC record. Like, I think this team felt at times like it you know, maybe wouldn't even make the NCAA tournament, and now they, you know, obviously just ran through what is still probably one of the best conferences in the whole sport.
Yeah, one of the, if not the best conference in the whole sport, one of the hardest schedules in the entire sport. Preseason, SU was projected somewhere between, like, 7th and 10th, I feel like, by most publications. Right now, we're ranked 9th by the Inside Lacrosse poll, so we've pretty much done what we were supposed to. I also feel like this year's weird. There's just not, like, and you've seen this the last couple of years as parity starting to take some hold in the sport, where, yes, it's the same 20 to 25 schools, but that's a much larger pool of teams to choose from as far as who's a national title contender than was the case even 5 years ago. So, you know, like, I think Maryland, Albany, probably, like, the two most, like, bulletproof teams in the country right now. But, like, you know, Duke obviously hasn't fallen off so much where they're not a title contender. Denver's up there every year. Yale, Cornell, like, Hopkins seems to be resurgent after a few, like, kind of lesser years of late. And Loyola, you know, they're not that far away from when they won a national title. So, I mean, even look at the Big Ten in general has found a way to really kind of up their product very quickly. Teams like Rutgers and Penn State, you know, have both really come on strong in recent seasons. So, I think this is going to be, like, similar to last year, a pretty wide-open NCAA tournament. It's going to depend on matchups. The hope, obviously, is that the Orange can
you know, get themselves a matchup that's advantageous early, and that plays to our defensive strengths. I know we have had some real nice defensive games in the second half of the season, while also struggling in some other spots. So, like most, you know, single elimination tournaments, this is going to be a matchup based thing, and I just hope we end up with the right one, since I feel like too often lately we end up with the wrong team staring across from us in the bracket.
Yeah, I mean, so many years we've had these, like, you know, crazy defensive, you know, goalie stands on his head games, and then the stall out finishes. So it'd be nice to just, like, finally get one where we seem to be pulling the upset and not, like, having this horrific last minute of agony, as we've had so many times in our NCAA tournament losses. Also, I don't know how Army did this year. Can we just not play Army?
I don't think Army's going to make it this year.
Okay, good. No offense to the Army.
We just don't want to play you in lacrosse ever.
We do not want to play you in lacrosse ever again in the NCAA tournament. So can we just not do that again? Everything else, like, I guess, you know, you kind of take it where it falls, but I think more often than not, we've been a pretty we've matched up pretty well with teams. It's just like Albany and Tornell were just clearly at a different level, at least on those days that we faced them. And Albany's been one of the best teams in the country all season. So I'd rather not face them early if possible. I don't think we'd get like a super early matchup with them, because I don't think we'd get seeded into a rematch like that. Although I guess we've had that with Army as well. So it's hard to always tell with how things work out because of travel and whatnot with the incident with the lacrosse tournament.
Yeah, I really don't want to face any of those teams. And I also don't want to face... I could face Rutgers, but I don't want to face them, to be honest. I don't really want to face anybody. I would face Yale, I guess. And I could face Hopkins and Loyola. But, like, besides that, I really don't want to face any of the teams we'd likely be lined up against.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of tricky because there's only so many teams that you can possibly be lined up against. Obviously, there's still some work to do with the ACC games, but I don't know, what's our like seed projection right now?
If I had to guess, and from what I've seen kind of bouncing around, we're like a fringe numbered seed.
That'd be nice. Get one at the dome if we can. Like, yeah.
Give us UMass at the dome, please.
Yes, I will take that. I know we've had we have a conspicuous history with UMass in the NCAA tournament, but I'll take it.
Yeah, give us UMass. I'll even take Nova.
I don't think we played Nova this year, did we?
No.
I don't think we really played them that much since we left the Big East. I'd take either of those. I haven't heard a lot of buzz about them, so that means that they're garbage and we'll beat them.
Yeah, sure.
That's how this works.
Yeah, give me them. Hey, I mean, Penn's 6-7 and they're still ranked, so give me them.
I'll take Penn, yeah. I know they've been dangerous in previous years, but I'll take them.
Yeah, actually, any of the receiving votes teams this week, I'll take any of those. That would be Vermont, Lehigh, St. Joe's, Ohio State, Michigan, Harvard, Richmond, or Brown. I don't really have like a huge problem with any of those. Really, my line is like anything. I'll take any of the teams below us, save Notre Dame.
Yeah, Notre Dame is always a trouble spot. I'd rather not. Not with them, and I know we beat them, but like
I don't care. I don't want to face them. just don't make me face them again. Tell the bad leprechaun man is just not something I want to see opposite us.
Yeah, I don't ever feel like super comfortable playing an ACC team early on, basically, or yeah. Maryland,
or Maryland. No, it's just
obviously Maryland this year, especially, but like. I just any team that we've lost to in the NCAA tournament before is just such a starring event in lacrosse. Like even if none of the players are the same, it's just I don't know. They all the losses just seem so brutal in terms of how they play out that I'm trying to think of like a basketball equivalent like
Butler.
I guess, but like even Butler's so different in terms of like the coaching now.
Yeah. Vermont.
Yeah, because we played Vermont again, and like everyone was like freaking out, and then we beat the hell out of them.
I was terrified.
Yeah,
because I remember the first game, so like I was still carrying the scars from that into that game. I know you weren't as much.
No, I mean I remember the game, the first game pretty well, but like I tried to be like sensible about it, and I get like if you were like a Syracuse fan, like really diehard at the time watching it, it would definitely be a little bit of a different ball game.
I think with basketball, I'm trying to think who.
Because I think the coach matters a lot, like in terms of the feel. Like, you don't want the same coach on the sideline. The players not as much, but right. Like in lacrosse, there's less coaching turnover.
Also less system.
So like Army just feels like a nightmare, even if they're terrible. Like Army could be 5-11 to make the tournament somehow, and I will think we probably are going to lose.
One comparison could be like Marquette. Like, I feel like, you know, we faced them a couple times in the postseason. They had that lucky win against us in 2011. I feel like a lot of people were projecting that onto the 2013 Elite Eight matchup, and then we ended up, you know, basically bludgeoning them into submission.
Yeah, or I think even like UNC this year after we've just like really struggled to beat them the last couple of years. Like, right. If we played UNC in the NCAA tournament, even if it wasn't like a great UNC team, I think we'd be kind of spooked. Like,
I'd buy
probably
that.
Even more so than the Duke game. Because Duke, we've handled. Like, Duke, we were, like, just under 500 against since we joined the ACC. UNC, we've beaten, like, what, once?
Yeah, I think we're 1-7 now.
Yeah, so that would feel a lot worse, I think, just based on, like, that weird history, even though, like, half of it doesn't really matter.
I would agree. I think we're mostly done here, but one thing I did want to mention, and I know I said I wasn't going to mention it at all, but given that we're not really seeing a strong university response about this whole engineering fraternity Theta Tau thing, Syracuse, please get on this. It's going to be on every morning news show tomorrow, probably.
Oh, it's a PR nightmare. Oh, yeah. I think the DO, I saw the DO just got the video.
Yeah, the DO got the video. It's horrifying. And yeah, in general, you know, for a school that, again, houses Newhouse, we're not very good at this whole communications thing a lot of the time, which is, again, really weird. Expulsions. Part two, let's maybe start talking about the role the Greek life really plays on campus and how we might want to alter that going forward.
Yeah, and it's more than a Syracuse thing. Like, that's really all campuses. Like, we hear this stuff every year from all over the country.
Yeah.
But even just at Syracuse, like, reading the DO article, and at the bottom, they're like, oh yeah, this fraternity and this fraternity and this fraternity and this fraternity are all also suspended. It's like, all right, well, if you're going to have, like, I don't know how many frats are on campus now. Let's say roughly, even if you're going to have, like, 15% of your total fraternity suspended for either hazing or just violent racism, like, what are we doing? And I'm just not trying to, and we bring this up all the time, and it turns into, like, a contentious thing online, but
I already tweeted about it earlier, and everyone's, the frat defenders are coming out.
Right. And I get that a lot of people have probably had very good experiences in the frat, and there was no crazy, like, racism and anti-Semitism in a lot of these frats, and that's great, and we're thrilled that that's the case, hopefully, in the majority of these places. And I have friends who were in frats who said, like, you know, who had really good experiences and said none of this stuff happened.
Same.
But, yes, and they do all do some good things, which is nice, but, like, most of the good things they do can be done outside of that system, which clearly houses a very beyond normal amount of just horrible stuff. Like, this isn't, like, something that happens in, like, every other friend group around campus. It really doesn't. Like, I don't think anyone would believe that if you said it. So it's not just, I don't think it's, like, a numbers thing. I think it's like, this, it's just such a high percentage of incidents with fraternities, specifically at Syracuse and across the nation. So, yeah. There definitely needs to be more of, like, a national conversation about what the utility is here, because I think most of the good things about them, you can accomplish without them. And that, like, you know, it sucks for those who have had good fraternity experiences, but at what cost are we doing this?
Yeah, I mean, at some point there's definitely a correlation, and that doesn't mean you have to lump every single person, but it means you have to talk about the overall impact on the community. This also is just, and some people have already brought this up talking about this conversation, like, this just getting rid of, even if you did just decide tomorrow, if Kent just decided to get rid of fraternities tomorrow, that would only scratch the surface of what's wrong on a lot of campuses. But, you know, that is a step, I think, in the right direction. But I would say that the university probably falls short of that action. But you know, hopefully, on the good side, maybe this introduces some new conversations on campus and on other campuses of what makes sense. I mean, I think if you do the things that are depicted in the video, if you
And if this is something that's not like a one-off and is a tradition of sorts, and that's horrifying to even think about, I think it becomes, you obviously thought it was okay, and you obviously thought that nothing would happen to you for doing it. And if that's the environment that's on campus, you know, at that fraternity and in Greek life overall and on Syracuse's campus and on other campuses, then most times you would automatically, you know, move to start, you know, stopping things in their tracks, because it's very obvious that the campus culture is fostering some sort of, you know, feeling that you're safe making these sorts of decisions and having these sorts of views. I'm disturbed. I know you're disturbed by it. I hope anyone who went to school is disturbed by it, and maybe this starts sparking a conversation about how we can improve, you know, Syracuse campus life. I hope a lot of alums, whether you're in Greek life or not, speak up about, you know, what the school has a responsibility to do here in the aftermath.
Yeah, and a point about the leadership from the school here. When, and this isn't a point I came up with, a friend brought it up after the story broke earlier. When Sifuru took over the school, like, he made such a big part about of his like early messaging, railing against like the whole party school persona that Syracuse has kind of taken on, largely I think outside of its own like doing. I think just some magazines decided this was a thing that we were, so that became a thing we were,
because we had nothing else to do besides drink it, you know, in the winter months,
right? Which was like, I think, largely unfair, but whatever. And that became such a big thing for him early on, so you would think that when these like very notable incidents happen where you can point to exactly where the problem is going on, like, you'd think he would have more of a direct response to this, and instead we have kind of gotten what we've gotten, which is not great. So that's really disappointing, and hopefully he does take a more pointed stance that's more consistent with what he's talked about with just like party culture in general, which I think is a lot less of an issue than like what is going on with these fraternities when there are so many incidents, to the fact that we now have like 5 fraternities suspended from campus, which I don't even think is like, I think when I was there, it was maybe 1 or 2 at any given time.
Yeah,
and same. Now something is like clearly blown up, and I don't know if it's more attention or if it's social media spreading videos like this, but like clearly there's something out of whack with like what we're worried about with like the general student populace, like drinking off campus, versus like this just horrible, horrible stuff that's going on that actually affects people on campus.
I would agree. I will definitely probably be writing something tonight. It's going to piss people off. I don't really care anymore because, you know, people do notice these things. No, it's not going to come up in the next job interview for a Syracuse grad necessarily, but it's more about pride in your school, your pride in your community, and the degree you have, the larger fan community you're a part of. I would think that just about everybody in the Syracuse community is against the sorts of things that are depicted in this video. And if you are for the things depicted in the video, please leave. Like the general Syracuse fandom, I'm fine with you leaving. I'm fine with you not reading the blog ever again. I really don't give a shit.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty unremarkable take there. I think we can all dip behind that.
Agreed. Cool. That was an abnormal way to end this, but
hopefully the only time we'll ever end a podcast like that.
I would agree. Dan, anything else before we sign off and invite? I'm sure there's going to be some hate mail for reasons unknown.
Yeah, no, I think we got everything.
Cool.
Good. Cool. Congrats, Rhett Culpepper, on playing at the end of the spring game. That was awesome.
Yeah, let's end this on a positive note. I'm sure everyone's seen it by now. Rex Culpepper did get to throw a touchdown pass to end the spring game. Really cool moment for him. He was in between treatments for testicular cancer. I know he started his second round of chemo this week. So best of luck to him. Definitely something that I know for a lot of people, you know, cancer is a real problem in our society, in our culture, and just from a health perspective. And a lot of people know someone who either has dealt with it or passed away from it. So, you know, obviously a genuine thoughts and prayers to Rex as he continues that fight. And hopefully we see him on the field again soon.
Absolutely.
All right, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy News and Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and Go Orange.
Go Orange.